Want to attract new people to your organization? A popular, alleged solution is to offer a general discount on admission. But does this work?
There are many kinds of museums. From the supersized Smithsonian to the childhood home of Muhammad Ali, from Bangkok to Boston, and everywhere in between. But museum goers only see part of the full picture. On this show, we open the crates, tell the stories, meet the people, and reveal the inner workings, unseen, unheard, until now. From Philbrook Museum of Art and Public Radio Tulsa, I'm your host, Jeff Martin, and this is Museum Confidential. For the past few years, in various workshops and meetings, at seminars and conferences around the country, one name keeps popping up as one of the most important young voices on the future of museums. That name and person is Colleen Dillon-Schneider. Through short videos, presentations, and data-driven articles, Colleen consistently boils down industry studies and presents them in a digestible and reliably optimistic way. Think Malcolm Gladwell, if he put most of his focus on museums and nonprofits, and if he was a giddy millennial. To kick off the new year and the new decade, we wanted to sit down and chat with Colleen, get to know her a little bit, and look at that future she's always talking about. I guess basically, I'd like to begin with a little bit about you specifically and talk about how you kind of ended up where you are. I go to a lot of conferences and I follow a lot of museum threads, and I often see your name and also, you know, quotes from you and you know, so you've certainly found your way into the museum industrial complex. And I'm interested in how that happened, you know, how this path was formed and how you got where you are.
Yeah, thank you. I hear, before we start, I hear a good amount about you too. I think the world of people, the world of people who are vocal online and have online presences in the museum world is small enough to keep track of, and I'm grateful for that. So I've heard a great deal about you as well. So when you reached out, I knew exactly who you were.
That's great.
And Philbrook, of course.
That's great.
Philbrook, you guys are always leading the edge. But I have always been a bit of a museum nerd. I grew up going to museums with my family, specifically my mom. And then when I went to college, when I was in college, I went to school at the University of Chicago. So I was right in the city when I had access to all these incredible institutions and would spend, you know, my afternoons off going to museums. And I'd just always been that kind of person. The way that my career has landed me where I am, I'm going to say what you shouldn't say. I think it's of course, a conglomerate of a lot of hard work, but also some luck. I started out at a science museum in Seattle called Pacific Science Center, doing marketing and events. And from there, I wanted to dive into how do I get into leadership roles? How do I start making change and navigate the world of nonprofit organizations? So from there, I went off to graduate school at USC, but I was really anxious about leaving the full-time museum world. We're a bit of a hierarchical profession. So I was really scared to leave what I'd been doing and just become a full-time student. So that is when I started Know Your Own Bone, the website that I operate. And at that time, that was 10 years ago. And at that time, it was mostly aggregate of what museums were doing in the online space. I was in meetings and folks were saying, you know, what is this book face? Do we need to be on this Twitter twatter? So there was all sorts of concern about where people were going with social media. So Know Your Own Bone was just a conglomerate of what museums were doing. And I got really lucky. The right people started reading it at the right time. And my first gig on the speaking circuit was actually a audio recording for IMLS. And from there, my name got circulated a little bit. More and more people started reading Know Your Own Bone. And then I was lucky to be on the speaking circuit in graduate school, leaving school to go to to conferences and talk about all of the great things that museums were doing on social media. And it was there that I was at. I was actually at the AZA, the Association of Zoos and Aquariums, and I was giving a presentation. And unbeknownst to me, several entities that I would later end up working with, Shedd Aquarium, National Aquarium, wherein I now serve on the board of directors, and Monterey Bay Aquarium, they were in the audience. And from there, they contacted this predictive technology and market research company, which is Impacts, the company with which I'm affiliated. And they said, hey, you know, there's a rogue millennial on the loose. And she's at conferences and she's talking about how museums are using digital technology. So I got really lucky. Impacts scooped me up. And at that time, it's a data company. And we had this large survey of non-proprietary data that the company was just sitting on, that we're using it as R&D. It's informing a lot of the work that we're doing with for-profit organizations, but we're not giving it in large mass to any cultural organizations. So I said, being my millennial self, you know, hey, I have this blog. Can I start just putting out some of this really expensive data for free for a little while? And at first, they said, okay, you know, today you can. And, you know, the next week, okay, today you can. All right, today you can. And it just snowballed to having kind of the readership and the impact that it has today. And there isn't a day I don't pinch myself that I'm so lucky to be of service. I hope that I'm of service. That's the goal to so many cultural executives in regard to how do we reach audiences, how do we understand visitor behaviors and motivations. And that's kind of where I landed.
You mentioned IMLS, and for those who may not know what that means, it's the Institute of Museum and Library Services. This is an organization that's very kind of tied into funding for museums. And it seems like timing was a big part of this, meaning 10 years ago, as the world is starting to change in terms of how we communicate and how we deal with the kind of end user when it comes to museums, you were there at the right time. And there were some of these industry organizations like IMLS or anybody else that were at least willing to say, hey, we see something coming. We may not know how to deal with it or how to work with it, but we're going to at least engage with people who are interested in exploring that. And you were one of those people, right, at that time. So what would have changed if the advent of new media, social media, didn't happen? You know, would you have stayed on some museum path regardless?
When I went to grad school, I had always intended to be working with museums. That had always been a passion of mine. So I went to grad school for that purpose. So probably I like to think I'd be still working with museums. I'm really intrigued by the spark moments that we provide as museums and how we educate and inspire people. And I believe change communities. And one of my favorite parts in working with data is that I get to actually see the big changes that museums are making and the spark moments that they're creating and the ripple effect. But you're exactly right. I was, at the time that I started Know Your Own Bone, you know, that movie, Julie and Julia, you know, about the blogger was coming out, and blogs were all the rage at the time when I started Know Your Own Bone. So it was just natural that, you know, I'm having this anxiety, I'm leaving my full-time museum job, I'm going to start a blog in my pajamas. And, you know, it's interesting because there isn't a day in my life, actually, there isn't, where I don't thank myself, my past self, for not calling my website, you know, Colleen's Cool, Cute, Cultural Corner,
yeah,
or something absolutely terrible, because I had no idea when I started Know Your Own Bone 10 years ago that it would be my career, my profession. And a little backstory on Know Your Own Bone: the title Know Your Own Bone comes from a famous quote from Henry David Thoreau: do what you love, know your own bone, nod it, bury it, unearth it, and nod it still. And I like to think that at my best, my job is to be curious and to ask questions. And what I love about the museum industry, among so many other things, is that at our best, I think that that's most folks in the museum industry's job too, to ask questions, to get to the root of what's happening, and to be curious. We are innately curious, you know, environments for curious people.
I liked what you said about curiosity, because I feel exactly the same way. I think, you know, I work with a lot of different people who have, you know, various levels of education, most far beyond me. We have, you know, PhDs and master's degrees and all these different things and different backgrounds. Some people come to it from an anthropological background. Some people come from an education track, all different things. But there is that curiosity that connects us. I do wonder, do you think that is something that's in you from day one. I don't know for sure if that level of curiosity can be taught. I think it can be fostered. I think it can be recognized, and someone, you know, can help you follow that curiosity. But is that something you think is in us from day one?
I think, well, obviously, this is, of course, a personal opinion. I think that curiosity is in all of us. And the question is, does it get sparked? And what I love about museums, and probably why I'm working with museums, is because it was at a museum that I was sparked. Going to museums has always just been a thing that my family did. I started as an art nerd. I still am an art nerd. I started very much with my entry to museums being art. And my spark organization, I keep saying my spark moment. In our industry, one of my favorite things to talk about is this idea of so many of us, and Jeff, I wonder if you have one too, but so many of us have these moments when we get down to the nitty-gritty of what drives us to do the work that we do, is we have these moments. You know, maybe you went to Gettysburg with your grandpa and he's really into history, and then now you're working at a historic site. Or maybe you did what happened to me, you went on a special day with your mother to a Monet exhibit at the Art Institute of Chicago, and now you are writing a website about high confidence data for the cultural sector. Or maybe you went to a symphony with your friend, and then from then on you became, you know, a conductor. There are these moments that we provide, of course, for the people who come into our doors, but I think that I got lucky, and I wonder if you did too. I got lucky in that from a young age that spark was cultivated in me. Do you have a spark moment like that?
Yeah, mine probably comes from books, I think. There was a time when I was a kid where most of the books I was reading were given to me or assigned to me, and then there was a moment where I went to the library and started looking for certain things myself. And that moment was probably around age 10. And it's funny you mentioned Gettysburg. It was very much driven by an interest in the Civil War. I think when I was about 10 or 9, my dad saw the Ken Burns documentary and had recorded it off of the television on VHS tapes. And I think I was homesick. I was homesick from school one day and I had nothing to do, and I was sick of watching, you know, soap operas or whatever was on. And I just popped in a couple of these VHS tapes and started watching this documentary. And I had no interest up till that point, at least, in history or in the Civil War. And I remember watching all of those and going into my school library when I went back to school and checking out a book on the Civil War. And it was the first time that I think I had, on my own steam, you know, sought out something intellectually where it was like I learned something and I wanted to take that next step of wanting to know more than what was presented to me. Yes. So I think, yeah, if I had to boil it down, I think you're right. We have everybody probably, whether you know it or not or can recognize it or not, had that moment somewhere.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's one of my favorite things to think about, because what we try to do is to spark that moment in other people, to become scientists, to become artists, to become therapists, to become lawyers, to become doctors, to become anything that they want to be under the sun. Our aim is to spark people. And so it's so interesting to me to note that us folks in the industry have those spark moments ourselves. It's a little bit meta, but
yeah,
it's kind of fun.
When you were starting the blog and you were kind of coming into your own as a public persona, because there is that element to it, a lot of it, and still to this day, is about aggregating data and all that stuff. But at some point, you started providing your own takes. You know, it wasn't just data. It wasn't just, here's what somebody else says. At some point it became, here's what Colleen says and thinks, you know, and kind of you had to come into your own and see enough in the world and aggregate enough stuff to where you could start to draw your own conclusions. When did that shift start to take place where you kind of felt more and more confident about being that person?
Like any job, it's a thing that happens over time. One thing that's interesting about the work that I do is the data that I talk about and that I share on Know Your Own Bone and that I'm able to share in workshops and talk about with client organizations, it comes from a study that is called the National Awareness Attitudes and Usage Study. And it is believed to be the largest in-market survey of perceptions and behaviors surrounding cultural organizations in the United States. So cultural organizations are, of course, zoos, aquariums, museums, but also, you know, botanic gardens, symphonies, science centers. And it is a very large, high confidence tool. And when I first started, I think I started like everybody else, you know, when you first start working with data, asking a lot of questions. And over time, you know, there are certain data polls I've seen pulled over 100 times. Questions like, are people in my market connected to the internet? This right. is like an example of data I've seen, you know, so many times. We've seen it so many times, cut in so many ways by different household incomes, by different ages, by different demographics. You name it, we've probably pulled for it. And then once you see the same large scale, high confidence data pulled in different ways so many times, you get more confident in talking about the outcomes of that data, especially if you aren't. One thing that has kind of helped me is that, you know, when I say something on Know Your Own Bone, oftentimes, of course, it's said in my voice, but oftentimes in the analysis, it's backed by the perceptions of 139,000 individuals. So that kind of helps there too.
Right.
I'm not coming at there alone. I have the ghost of 139,000 individuals, but certainly it comes from my perspective. And one thing that you mentioned that's really interesting about that is I need, and anybody who's in my position, I think it's responsible to have, I need editors and I need to have people whose job it is to help keep me on track and keeping my own biases out of the data-informed articles. So what that means is that every set of data that is articulated on Know Your Own Bone has been articulated to me by a data analyst, where I've gotten to ask questions about what it means, what it doesn't mean. And then on the back end, I always have between one and three editors whose sole job in this project is, or one of their sole jobs in this project is to make sure that what I'm putting out isn't, you know, Colleen thinks and that's it. And that's been a fine line, right? Because a part of Know Your Own Bone is my tone. I'm really overly excited millennial data right. nerd. And there's no way around that. I'm just excited. And some of the data is pretty hard hitting. And some of the data is really hard, you know, for folks to accept or take on. And once you have to not fight that battle, because it's certainly not a battle, but once you have to hold hands in getting people to accept certain things, like the fact that, for instance, one of the most popular ones that's difficult for folks is this idea that being free isn't necessarily the same as being perceived as welcoming. Once you have to, but that's a really hard-hitting thing in our world. In our world, sometimes we think if we make something free, that means everybody who felt that that place was intimidating, everybody who felt like they didn't belong there, suddenly they're going to run in the doors and say, well, now I belong. I was just waiting for that free sign. But we find over and over and over again in the data that more times than not, that's not, you know, necessarily the case. And that's something that's really hard for us in the museum industry, because we want to believe that we want to be accessible. And that is, that can be a step to doing that when it's done strategically and thoughtfully. But it opens the door to a lot of really difficult, hairy conversations. And that's something that I find that I do on a regular basis, is open the door to some really difficult conversations. And I like to say that on Know Your Own Bone, you know, about 85% of Know Your Own Bone is high confidence data that's incredibly validating. You know, I thought that, you know, facilitating shared experiences and connecting people to each other was important. And now I see the data, I know it is, and I can go forth and armed with this data to make some decisions. And then there's about 10% of it that's, oh, that's interesting. I haven't thought about it that way before. But then there's 5% that is, you know, get out of town. You know, I just can't. That hits up to a cognitive bias that I have. I've been operating under certain assumptions for several years and in some cases several decades. And that's really challenging for me. And that's human. Having those kind of feelings in regard to data, that's absolutely human. And I have them too when I see the data very, very frequently. So in being a voice for this kind of data, it's this fine tightrope of how do I make it engaging? How do I make it accessible? How do I make it kind of fun? But how do I make it also accurate, and so it can actually be beneficial to organizations, so that it has the least opportunity to be misinterpreted?
This episode of Museum Confidential is brought to you by Art Printed on Stuff. Why spend time schlepping through the museum and dealing with all those self-conscious people oohing and aahing at everything, when we already have most of your favorite images superficially adorned on coffee mugs, flash drives, pencils, and decorative plates? Remember, with Art Printed on Stuff, we don't just bring you the art, we make it accessible for those who really didn't want to come here in the first place. Art Printed on Stuff. For the rest of us.
How do you know when your work is successful? You know, you're putting a lot of stuff out in the world, and it's through reading online, it's through this big amount of video production you're throwing out there. You have all these different things, and you're putting ideas out into the world. What's the metric for knowing whether that's actually working or if you're just speaking into an echo chamber? You know, how do you actually kind of gauge that when some of the things you're trying to do are bigger ideas, like impacting a whole industry writ large? How do you kind of have any sense of impact on that?
That's a really good question. And that's something that I struggle with quite a bit. One thing that I have noticed about Know Your Own Bone readers is that the kind of people who read Know Your Own Bone, it goes back to being curious, tend to be the folks who are saying, hey, I'm running up to something in my work and I want to know what the market really thinks. So I'm realizing the value of being data informed. And what that means is not everybody wants to read Know Your Own Bone. Not everybody feels comfortable diving into, well, how much does education inform the experience versus entertainment? Some people would just rather not know, because sometimes, you know, we've been operating on certain assumptions for, you know, several decades. One thing that I have noticed has been helpful is that I have an incredible community of readers who just astounds me very frequently in recommunicating findings to adding illustrative points or adding their own, you know, saying, hey, yeah, here's what we found in our institution and here's our data and we're finding that too. Or, you know, just the other day we were having a conversation about that and this came up. And a lot of it is talking and sharing and asking hard questions. And I value folks who can ask hard questions because I think that's the way that we grow. In terms of being, how do we know if it's implemented? This is an incredible question, because we frequently come up with that issue in the work that we do at Impacts. We work with some specific client institutions and we watch them. We are tracking their ongoing metrics, we're tracking their KPIs. But another big part of what I do is I have the incredible benefit of going around with my colleague, Jim Heckers, who's the former managing director of the Monterey Bay Aquarium, and we provide workshops. And in providing the workshops, we go in and we deliver a lot of high confidence information. And then the question is, what happens afterwards? Can we track them? What do we do? And what it comes down to is that being a data-formed organization is so much more than just having the data. It also has to do with how the data is interpreted, but most importantly, having the data be accepted. And that is where things get the hardest for me, but also I think in the industry, is that there are a lot of folks who see data, who understand that we're hitting rubber hits the road and living in a more digital connected world, but really accepting it and making that culture of being data informed something that's front and center. And so one thing that we do in a lot of cases is have to hand off the data. We have this high confidence data. We're watching organizations from 224 in the US. We see what's working, what's not. Here's what's working and what's not. We're sharing it with you. But at some point we have to say, and now it's up to you. It's up to you to communicate this to your board, or have us communicate it to your board and you want to communicate it down, or however you would like to do it. But at some point, it's a culture shift within cultural organizations. And it takes a lot of work and it takes a lot of effort, but it also takes a lot of people who are passionate about seeing the need for paying attention to how real life people and potential visitors are making decisions and what they think about our institutions and how welcomed they feel and how much they value what we're putting out there.
You talk often about the perspective that you have on things being from a millennial perspective. And a lot of the changes that we are hoping to see and make in the museum world have to take place on a pretty macro level. And I wonder how much of that is about generational shifts. Meaning, if you go to a conference of museum directors, you will notice that you're looking at upper level Gen X to boomer is kind of the standard age base for most museum leadership. Do you think that it's going to take the millennials getting into those positions of power to really fully implement some of the changes that are needed in the industry? And if that's the case, that's going to take another, you know, decade to two decades plus to kind of get into that space. And if that is the case, I'm adding a few questions here. Is that something that's daunting to you? Meaning like, well, we just kind of have to keep doing it and keep plugging away as the sands of time kind of change. I mean, what does the role of the generational change play in the bigger picture here?
I think what I'm supposed to say is, yes, that it's not going to change until millennials take the lead. But I don't believe that's true. I believe that I am seeing incredible, baby boomers and Generation X are making incredible changes to reach a bunch of different audiences. Indeed, we would benefit by having more millennials in leadership positions. But also part of that is simply because we are the largest generation in human history. And thus, it should be representative. Our leadership should be representative of the people that we're trying to serve. And for that reason, it makes sense that there should be significantly more millennials in leadership roles than there currently are. But I don't think that we can only move forward if it's all millennials, or, you know, even if it's a majority millennials. One thing that I think is happening is that leadership is turning over and changing, but so is who visits museums. And one thing we like to say at Impact is millennial talk is everybody talk. The data pans out to show that these things that we often attribute exclusively to millennials, like being digitally connected or really valuing personalization and transparency, those things are not owned by millennials. Increasingly, they are a consequence of the connected world in which we live, and in large part, the internet. And so increasingly, we're finding that all people kind of, if you will, baby boomers are going to squint, and especially Generation X, who are incredibly rad, are going to squint at this. But increasingly, we're all, I'm going to air quote, acting like millennials, because we all are living a world that is increasingly informed by digital communications and creating our perceptions about things before we come in contact with them in real life, because we come in contact with them on the internet and creating opinions about things.
Two recent news stories have a strange, if not so obvious, overlap. One, the unprecedented wildfires raging throughout Australia. The other, the death of legendary conceptual artist John Baldessari. He was 88. Before becoming a more experimental artist, Baldessari made paintings. Lots of paintings. In 1970, as his work was changing, he decided to have them all destroyed. That summer, all the paintings in his possession, dating from the years 1953 to 1966, were burned in a crematorium. The act itself was a performance he called the Cremation Project. The exact number of lost paintings is unknown. He later referred to this act as, quote, my best piece to date. That's our show for this week. Museum Confidential is produced and edited by Scott Gregory at the studios of Public Radio Tulsa. To learn more about what's going on at the museum and at the station, visit philbrook.org or publicradiotulsa.org, or both. We suggest both. Until next time, look closer.